Okay.
All right. Are we ready here? Record. Put it on the floor. How far can we go?
I think we're
good. Yeah, record. Testing.
Are you still getting feedback in your headphones?
No, but I'm not hearing anything in the headset, but I'm hearing it down there. Right?
Try. Let's see. Line.
Now we got it. Thank you. We're ready.
Okay. Well, this is Carl Brasso, and Don Davis is with me, and we're here on January 19th, 2011, with Robert Hoy and Metairie. And Mr. Hoy, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us today. As I indicated earlier, what we're interested in doing is recording for future generations the history of the Louisiana wetlands. And the participation of various groups that have become invisible, basically, to present generations of scholars. We'd like to begin by simply getting your permission to record this. These materials, the recorded materials, are going to go into collections at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, at LSU in Baton Rouge, and at the Sea Grant regional and national offices in Baton Rouge and Washington, D.C. These materials will be used for, we can't really envision at this point. We would hope that they will be used in books, maybe even in documentaries in years to come. Naturally, there's no remuneration involved for anyone in this kind of business, so there go the millions. But we would like to get your permission to use these for future researchers.
Sure, whatever it can be worth.
Now, you just mentioned to us that you were familiar with the Kwan Sun Company.
Yes.
How are you familiar with that?
My father and his partner actually operated the company.
Okay. Well, what was your father's name and your partner's name?
My father's name was Chin Dai Hoy, Sr. Mm-hmm. And his partner was Senior Moment.
Junior Moment.
Yeah. No, I'm not a junior, it was, I can't remember his name. I'll think of it later.
Okay.
But when was the partnership established, do you remember?
Actually, it was a corporation to start with, with a number of people that owned stock in the company. And as time went on, people either went back to China or they passed away. And eventually it boiled out to two people. Mm-hmm. And these two people essentially operated the corporation as a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, was your father a native of New Orleans?
No,
or was he an immigrant?
He was an immigrant. Mm-hmm. He came from China
many years ago.
Oh. he actually came over twice, I don't know, very early 1900s.
Mm-hmm. Why Louisiana? I know that there had been a Chinese presence here after the Civil War with people working in the sugar fields. Was there any connection with earlier family members who had come over?
It's my understanding, and I'm not real sure of all of this, but it was my understanding he had an uncle or something that was here already, and they were involved in setting up this stuff with the shrimp drying business. Mm-hmm. Apparently they recognized the fact that there was a great deal of resource down here for doing that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of people came over to sort of establish this business.
Did they come over as family groups, or were these just young men?
No, usually it was just young men that came over. Very rarely brought wives. In fact, I don't even know of any of them that brought wives.
Mm-hmm.
They would come and just get established, and some of them would go back and get wives and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
Did they always come through San Francisco?
Yeah, I think so. As far as I know, that was the major.
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
and there were shrimp frying platforms. I don't remember them, but I've seen images.
In San Francisco?
Yes. Yeah. These were not elevated above the marsh. They were on the hillside, and they were drying in the same techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this shrimp drying tradition in the early 1900s in San Francisco, and we find it here. Did your family have shrimp drying platforms?
Yes, they were associated with a number of them. There were quite a few of them down in the marshes at mm-hmm. the time that I knew of them. Of course, they're all washed away now. I think the only one that might have a presence still is Manila Village. The last I heard, there was one shack left or something there. But other than that, if you go down there, the last time that I saw them, there were just piles that were still in the water where the platforms stood at one time.
Do you remember the names of any of these platforms, other than Manila Village?
There was LNG, there was Bayou Brulo, Bayou Rigo, Basa Basa, I think, was another one. I don't really recall all of them, but
now,
there were a number of them down there.
Now, when did you pick up did your family pick up dried shrimp? And do you remember if they used sail or were they using gas boats?
When I was growing up, they had diesel-powered boats. They had, there was a kind of a ferry boat called the America, I think was the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a captain, and he would go around to the platforms and pick up the stuff, I think, and then bring it back to the city. Where they are essentially repackaged and
did they
it off.
Were they picking up shrimps in barrels or were they in a bag? I mean,
no, that I really don't know. I never really observed them doing this. The reason I knew about the America was we used to catch it to go down there to go fishing.
Okay,
uh-huh. But it was a nice sized boat, but you know it wasn't sail.
Okay, all right.
Now, your family was involved in the wholesaling of bulk
in essence,
quantities
yes.
of the proper,
yes.
The product?
Yes. Because on St. Louis Street, of course, you can't do any drying or anything down there.
Right.
So what they did was they brought it into the St. Louis Street property, and they did a cleaning process in the back, and then repackaged, essentially.
Mm-hmm. How was it cleaned?
They used a blower, and they handpicked the mm-hmm. other stuff, the big stuff out, and it, when I was going down there, they were no longer using barrels; they were using crates. They made wooden boxes, and they would pack these up and ship them out in wooden boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But they did have a couple of old barrels sitting around, so we were familiar with that.
Where were the principal clients, principal markets for the...
In China, mostly, mm-hmm. at that time. The people in the United States were not that familiar with dried shrimp until you had large populations of Orientals in the cities here, like in New York, San Francisco, in these areas. Then they had markets there. Chicago mm-hmm. was another one.
What parts of China? What were the main...
Mostly southern China, around mm-hmm. the Canton area.
Mm-hmm. Is that where your family was from, southern China?
Yeah, most of the people that came here from China in those days was from the southern portion of China.
Okay. Were they involved in the shrimp industry before coming?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Were the boxes made at 525 St. Louis, or were they... They were from a vendor who brought them.
They were from a vendor that bought them, brought them in. And as I say, at that time they were wooden boxes.
Yes.
Of course, they got to be too expensive, so they finally went to the cartons.
And how long was the family in the shrimp drying industry?
I guess my father was in it all of his life.
And did you inherit that, or did he?
Not really.
Okay. All right.
Chin Hong, that was his partner. As time went on, they sort of got old. They couldn't really operate the business that well. When my father passed away, then that's kind of when I got into it. But
about when was that?
Oh, now you're. I guess this was in the 80s. Something was around there.
So the company was perhaps 100 years old by then?
Possibly. I don't know the exact time of when it was organized.
But well over 50 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That works. That works. Yeah. Now, when you ship to China, would you ship directly from New Orleans or go by train to, say, San Francisco and then go to China?
I don't know the original way that they did it. By the time I got into it, you could no longer ship to China, of course. But they were sending to Hawaii and places like that, and the way they did that in those days was to ship it to San Francisco and then send it off on a boat, a steamer. And then later on, as more modern times came along, they shipped it by air. They just direct.
Air freight.
Yeah.
What about Central America?
No. As far as I know, they didn't have much down in Central America. They did at one time deal with Cuba. They did send stuff to Cuba, but of course that got cut off
right
after a while.
Right, because we had heard that some dried shrimp companies were shipping to Central America. The banana companies were buying it for their workforce.
I wasn't aware of that.
And that Bloom and Bergeron, for example, had on site a barrel maker.
Yeah,
because they were shipping by barrel. In fact, the Green Dragon logo, that's the top of a barrel. So
right.
we certainly know that the barrel is important. One of the things that's very hard for us to get a handle on is the supply chain. If you have a shrimp drying platform, somebody had to build it. And most of these were built in inaccessible places. They had to come with timber, probably cypress, that had to be brought in.
Yeah.
The shrimp were boiled. Your father represents a period when they didn't have natural gas, they didn't have diesel, so they were using wood. We know that each platform used 5 cords of wood a day. That's a
logistical nightmare, basically.
Yeah.
When we ask a question about sailboats, some of this was sailed, and so we ask these questions like, did you make the boxes? Because our interest is, where did the boxes come from? Were they made locally? Well, then that adds to the local economy. And really, these questions have never been asked. So we're always interested in how product moves. If you think about it, we have a product produced in Louisiana that's sold in Canton, China. In some cases, before World War II and maybe before World War I. We know that for Bloom and Bergeron, we think it was that early. It's a really important industry, and so all of your discussion just helps us, even how minor it may be. One of the things that we're interested in, did you ever get involved in producing the little shrimp in a small cellophane envelope, card shrimp?
Oh, yeah. The company did that.
Was that mostly for the Louisiana market, or because I'm from rural South Louisiana, and I know right. every Lent, people were using it to make stews and
gumbo.
Oh yes,
yeah, right. The company was into that. In fact, when I was operating the company, we had some of that going on. Of course, we had a little bit more modern modern facility, but...
How many people were in the workforce and at the location down on St. Louis Street? You know, when you were up and running and you were processing.
Yeah, well, it kind of varied, but as far as the car trip were concerned, they only had like two or three people for
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would bring in four or five people more when they were cleaning the shrimp
mm-hmm.
and packaging it. But other than that, that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
When you had the business, were you shipping? How did you? If I'm a grocery store
mm-hmm.
in Chinatown, San Francisco, and I sent you an order, would my order be 10 pounds, 30 pounds, 50 pounds, 100 pounds?
Usually they were sent in 50-pound lots in
okay.
the bulk.
That answers the question, because in 2008,
mm-hmm.
2009, my wife and I went to New York on holiday, but I went to Chinatown. And through Louis Bloom, I knew where there was one person selling Louisiana dried shrimp,
mm-hmm.
and it was in this huge container. And that answers the question. I also, because my roots are in California, I knew of a grocer in San Francisco. He also was selling it, but it wouldn't tell me the size. So why, I don't know. And it was selling for $30 a pound in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
And just short of $29 a pound
in New York.
Mm-hmm. How recent was this?
2 years ago.
Oh, wow. We should have been selling higher.
So it's, I was surprised.
Uh-huh.
My sister-in-law loves dried shrimp, so I paid $30 for a pound of dried shrimp, and I didn't care because it was something Carl and I were trying to understand.
Mm-hmm.
It still has a viable market. It also apparently has a market in the Hispanic population in the border communities.
Did you have brokers out in some of these places like New York and San Francisco?
The company did not have a broker in New York or Chicago or San Francisco. Well, they did have one in San Francisco, and they had one in Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
the ones that I knew of.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, they had one in Cuba when they were operating there. Because we met them once before the Castro.
Yes.
They were very nice.
Now, did you ever wholesale under any other label besides Quan Sun?
Yeah, there was a Gulf Food Products company is what they actually operated under when I was familiar
uh-huh,
with it.
Uh-huh.
Quan Sun Company was sort of the shell company. And they operated under Gulf Food Products, which was the partnership of the two men involved. But they also had one that they called LOG brand. And the reason for that, my understanding was that the LOG brand was sold in Hawaii, and they wanted two brokers there for some reason or another. Maybe for competition. So one of them was selling Gulf Food Products and one was selling LOG, but they were coming out of the same pot.
Now, would you have any of those labels or any of the paper goods from that period, anything at all?
I don't know of any offhand. The boxes, of course, we wouldn't keep the boxes around. Well, I might have had a Gulf Food Products box, but I'm not sure of that.
Okay.
You never know what's in the attic.
Yeah, they wouldn't let me into the attic at St. Louis Avenue because I figured there had to be something up there.
Yeah.
Those are the things that's very hard for us to get a handle on.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the Green Dragon shrimp,
mm-hmm.
Carl's University put out an announcement through their alumni paper that we were doing this oral history. We get a call from a former helicopter pilot who wanted to come visit with us. He thought he had something we might be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
We meet him in Lafayette and he hands us this rolled tube. He says, I think you might enjoy this. I want you to have this. I think it's important. It's just been in basically the attic. apparently his family had a camp that they used near whatever the Kwan Sun platform was.
Yeah.
And as a child, they played there.
Mm-hmm.
And we unroll, and there's six of these labels. And
of course, they're beginning to disintegrate. It's not in pristine condition
yeah.
like yours.
And the thing is, we were ecstatic because the hardest thing to do is find paper goods that tell you about what you're talking about. So if you have an old box, we want a photograph. If you have letterhead, we want to scan it. Because it gives us a real visual clue to what you're talking about. So when we found that, we were giddy as when I was 3 years old, open Christmas presents, because you don't find that.
Right.
Even maps of the property or hand drawings. Mr. Chinbo Wing, he hand drew for me the boats that were used. And so I have that, all that now is at ULL.
Mm-hmm.
But it was amazing. And he spent enormous amount of time explaining how this worked. One of the things we're interested in, do you remember if your family dried fish as well as shrimp?
Yes, they did.
What kinds of fish do you remember?
It's generally trout. Mm-hmm. Speckled trout is what they preferred for some reason or another. But what they would do is they would catch the fish, they would gut it, pack it with salt and then inside the fish, and then pack it on the outside with fish. And they would stick all of these into a barrel and put a great big weight on top of it. And
dry.
It became a brine solution underneath it, and this was a preservative for the fish, but you had to press it down to squeeze all the fluids out, I guess. And then after a while, they would take them out, then they would let them dry. And they were apparently pretty well preserved because people would use them.
This was for the Chinese market again?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a pretty smelly operation. It's a pretty smelly food, too.
Well, we were told by a Mr. Bouquet, who still runs it's not a platform. He shrimp fries.
Yeah.
That he remembers as a boy walking out on the platforms, and that they were run by what he called Manila men, and that for their market they liked the shrimp to have a little odor, and that intrigued us because to us we don't want an odor,
mm-hmm.
but to that their market they had to have a little bit of an odor, which we had not heard before. So the idea that it has a little odor falls right in line with what Mr. Bouquet told us.
There's no problem with having an odor.
Well, as a child, did you play at 525 St. Louis?
We used to go down there occasionally. We didn't spend a great deal of time down there, but we did go down there on occasions. We did spend some time on the platforms when we go fishing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so I became familiar with it at that time because just byproduct, we weren't interested in the shrimp, we were interested in going fishing.
How many people would be at a platform at that time, you know, working it?
Oh, I have no idea. There were quite a few because they had to do it all by hand.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, they had to spread the shrimp out after it was boiled. They had to spread it out over the platforms. Then they had to make sure that if it started to rain, they could cover it real quickly. So they had to have a lot of people around to do that. And they had to turn the stuff every so often with rakes and that sort of thing.
Did people live at the platform, or did they live
yes.
on boats, or was there...
No, the platforms had associated with it some small buildings that they used for transient workers, I guess. The workers there and also the fishermen would live there too sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually had a little market that was associated with it, like a grocery store, so that people could go in there and buy whatever they needed.
Now, were there entire families there? I know in the late 19th century there were in certain platforms.
Yeah, some small families, I guess, were living down in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we got there, there weren't too many of those left.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since there were families, do you know if any of them had a post office? Now, there was a post office
at Manila Village.
Okay, all right. Now, that's gone through lots of owners. It was the Fisher Company.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lost track of it. Of course, the Fisher was a senator.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a Fisher High School that Carl and I've seen in Lafitte.
Mm-hmm.
Did your family have close working relationships with the Manila Village?
Manila Village was owned by Chin Hong Bo. No, Chin Bo Wing.
Yes.
He was my uncle.
Okay, all right.
He was my father's cousin.
All right, also from Canton.
Yes.
Okay.
Probably the same village.
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
Yeah. Now, you went out there to fish, just basically to enjoy
it. Just recreation.
Okay. Now, do you have any brothers and sisters do the same thing?
I have two brothers.
Okay.
The one that's closest to me was only about a year older than me. We used to go down at the same time for fishing. My oldest brother actually had moved to San Francisco and was going to school there. My father felt he should learn Chinese. there was no place here that they could learn that sort of thing. So he sent them out there for that purpose. And he went through high school out in San Francisco. So we weren't associated that closely with him during the period where we were going fishing down.
Just out of curiosity, did he stay in San Francisco or did he come home?
No, he came back here and then eventually moved back to California, but Southern California.
Yeah, one of the employees for Louis Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
Worked the platforms, apparently moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually went looking for the grocery he owned, and the site has been turned into a church.
Cool.
He named one of his sons Louisiana and one son Terrebonne. And he did so because the shrimp drying industry, as an immigrant, provided him the first form of employment.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately left Louisiana. And Carl asked a good question, because many people who were of Chinese ancestries came here and then moved to a place where you could learn Chinese. And it would be in San Francisco, New York, Boston, Montreal.
Yeah, there was a more viable community where the language was still spoken.
Yeah,
sure.
In fact, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you at some point when we're done with the dried shrimp industry about the Chinese community here in New Orleans, because there's, aside from one or two small publications I can think of, but the Chinese community here is largely forgotten by Louisiana historians and geographers.
Yeah, if you don't mind just chatting about it. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. My father worked in San Francisco. He worked on the docks. And from about age 9 to 16, about every other weekend, I was just left on my own in San Francisco. So I'd take the cable car to Chinatown. And I would just wander the streets, and it was perfectly safe. And I worked with Chinese. And it was always interesting to me that they'd say at that time, go to Chinatown and see things made in Japan, because we have an embargo. and therefore, I have a real interest. You know, I learned where most of the good restaurants were, and because I was a young child, but I just wandered and looked. And yet, we know of only of Harry Lee may have been able to provide some background, because his family was in, still is, in the restaurant trade. But if you don't mind just commenting about the Chinese population in...
Yeah, well, just the Sicilians are coming in about the same time as many of the Chinese immigrants here. Mm-hmm. And basically, the model for their, because they've been studied much more extensively, with them, they tended to settle together in an area and then quickly disperse out into the suburbs. And I was wondering if that's the model of what happened with the Chinese, because we know there was a small Chinatown in New Orleans about 1900.
Yeah, the Chinatown here was only like two stores or something like that. I would say that the people, the Chinese here that came here, did not remain within that location.
Mm-hmm.
They spread out to the different areas. They didn't congregate into.
That's what happened with the Italians, right?
But they, I guess their point of meeting was the Chinese church, the Presbyterian church that was established here, and so most of the people use that sort of as a social gathering point, as well as presumably for the religion.
Now, where was that?
Well, it started off on when I got it associated with it was on Roman Street, and but there was a place before that, and I can't remember exactly where it was. But we can go back into the history of it and see where it was. I think Liberty Street, South Liberty Street. Then it moved to Roman Street, and then it moved to Bienville. After some temporary homes, they moved to Bienville Street, and eventually that neighborhood became unviable. And so they moved out to Kenner on West Esplanade Avenue, and it's currently still in operation.
Well, that's like the Greek Orthodox. You rarely hear about the Greek Orthodox, but they have a very large church.
Oh yeah,
off of Bayou St. John,
Robert E. Lee Boulevard. Right.
Yeah, and again, it's one way that we can get some understanding of migration and what happens. Now, did your family always live in Metairie, or did you move here from?
No, we actually lived in New Orleans proper, in the sort of central portion of the city, between Canal and Tulane Avenue. There's some small areas in there that were livable. But eventually we moved to Lakeview. We lived on Canal Boulevard, actually. And until everybody passed away, then we sold the property there. And of course everybody had already dispersed. My two brothers both live in California, so they're not no longer in this area.
They're not part of the Houdat Nation.
That's right. That's right. they're not here.
Now, did you go to school in... you did not go to San Francisco.
No.
So you went just public
just
or private
public,
school?
Public schools here. I went to Warren Easton. When we finished there, I went to Tulane. And service and all of that stuff. It's fairly common, so.
Did Rose go to Tulane as well?
She went to Newcomb when it was still Newcomb.
Newcomb, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And as the family evolved in the shrimp drying business, you saw a lot of change. And if you don't mind talking about the change you remember. And it could be something so simple as, you know, rather than hand picking, we used a blower. Those things are important in how this industry evolved with technology.
Well, the biggest change that I saw was that they were no longer able to sun dry the stuff, which was a practical process. It didn't take a lot of energy.
Yes.
But now they have to dry them in these dryers artificially. And it took them a while to get settled down on how much they should dry them in that process and how quickly they should dry them. They went through some growing pains with that, because when they initially started that, they dried them on the outside too fast. And what would happen is the moisture would stay on the inside of the shrimp. So after about a week, the inside moisture would go out and everything turned bad. And it took them a while to settle on exactly how to do that. I don't know if they've still got it down yet, but I'm not involved in that, so I don't worry too much. But yeah, it was quite a problem. And as far as drying is concerned, after you dry, you have to do the cleaning process. And ever since I've known it, they've always used these blowers to blow the husks away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, they use the beaters to beat the shells off. So the process was that they boil the shrimp, they would dry the shrimp, either through the sun or through artificial drying, and then they would beat the shrimp to beat the husks and the shells off of them, and then they would blow it, so that this blowing process would blow all of these shells away, where presumably the shrimp would just fall down
mm-hmm.
and be fairly clean, and then they would run a hand-picking process to take the large stuff out. You might end up with fish, you know, or all sorts of things in it. And then they would just package it from there.
What about the shells? I know some the blooms had found a market for the meal made
yeah.
up of the ground shells. Did you market that as well?
A little bit of it, yeah. We didn't do a great deal of it. Bloom was in a better position to do that because the platforms were all around him.
Hmm.
And what he would do is, when they beat the shrimp, have you seen the beater?
Yes.
The shells and stuff would fall down underneath it. And so he'd just have men go in there and shovel it out. And they would use that either as fertilizer or fish food or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a ready market for that. We had a little bit of it, but not a great deal. It wasn't a prime sort of thing for us. He had to move a lot of product to make anything out of it.
Oh, yes. Yes. And they're still in the business.
Yeah, they're still there.
And they've kept a lot of records and have been very good to Carl and I. It was Lewis's dad that made a listing of the platforms he remembers. Mm-hmm. And that listing is at 80. And we think it goes to 100 because they came and went. Every hurricane, they were gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, they came and went, and we suspect that collectively there may have been over 100. And we really suspect that not all, but most of them had Chinese working on every platform.
Yeah, and what's amazing to me is that they kept rebuilding them after these catastrophic storms,
mm-hmm.
and often many people were drowned, you know, during the storms. So.
Sure. No, it's amazing that they still have pilings down there.
Well, in some ways, the term you're hearing now is resiliency. In some ways, the platform entrepreneurs and their employees were exceedingly resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though they may have lost a loved one, they went right back they didn't even hesitate. Boom, they were right back in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we like to tell people that the platforms were making more money than the governor of the state of Louisiana. And people do the same thing. We just don't tell them that it wasn't until Huey Long was appointed, elected governor, that the governor even had a salary. We just don't tell people that prior to 1928, the governor never had a salary. So everybody made more money than the governor.
Oh, all right.
But it's a viable industry and one that we're real fascinated to try to understand.
I'm not sure how viable it's going to be because it's kind of going away, I think.
Well, you know, that happens with lots of industries.
If you lose the marshlands, you're losing
yes
nursery grounds.
Exactly. Exactly. And one reason we're here today is that that happens. We at least have one story that 30 years, 40 years from now, somebody will be able to understand.
I was very surprised to hear they had them in San Francisco.
They were in Marin County.
Yeah. Did they have a lot of shrimp there?
Yes. They're not you would probably call them sea bob. They were this small seven barb. But it was really, it was a very large industry. And in fact, there is a California park called China Camp. And China Camp was one of these shrimp drying operations. Very ephemeral. It's all gone. It's an archaeological artifact. But we have some photography that's just magnificent. And the boat type is like the traditional Chinese junk. But when you look at the aft, the tiller looks an awful lot like what we find on a sailing lugger. Yet Carl and I have never found any reference to Chinese shipwrights, boat builders. And with the population we suspect is in the wetlands, it would not be unrealistic to say that some of these folks made their own boats. But we have no record of it. But your instincts tell you that if you have some downtime, you're from Canton, you're associated with water, there's some spare lumber around.
And you're living out on the water.
That you may, in fact, have built your own boats.
Sure.
Because we see some design elements that look like they could have come from China, but have no way of proving it.
That's interesting.
It is. Yes.
Why did the industry die out there? I think
that the property became so valuable that it just wasn't viable to use it for shrimp drying. You know, it's Marin County. I just think that by the beginnings of, well, before World War One, before World War Two, pardon me, the property was starting to escalate in value, and they had another source, Louisiana. But nobody has written that I've seen about the evolution of shrimp drying in San Francisco Bay. It's an interesting story. There are some accounts written in the late 1800s, early 1900s, but neither one of us has sort of gone to the UC Berkeley system and sorted through their. They have some excellent oral archives. I suspect that, you know, that they couldn't compete with the Louisiana market, would be my guess. Once you got rail service to San Francisco, everything changed. Because rail service allowed you to move barrels very competitively. And, you know, you were producing probably more in a day than these platforms were produced in 3 days. So it doesn't, you know, you do the numbers, it just got overwhelmed. And my guess is it all came from Louisiana. But they were there. Some of the design elements are very similar. We're particularly intrigued by the boats because I, not the sails. The sails.
The platforms themselves, though, are very much like the ones used here.
The waves.
Yep, exactly. So it's a neat connectivity. And it, my guess is that the Louisianians just took over the market. And it's still a viable market to Louis Bloom.
And apparently to merchants in California, New Orleans, at $30 a pound.
It's, yes. Yep.
I don't know, Don.
I think you've answered our concerns, questions.
I don't know very much.
Oh, trust me.
We know.
Trust me. No, we just really appreciate you taking the time and chatting with you.
Because, as we said earlier, if you don't share your memories, then the experience is basically going to be lost as far as historians are concerned, because there'll be no records for them to turn to.
Or even your own children. We've been asked by a businessman if we would just sit and chat with him, because his children and grandchildren, certainly his grandchildren, have no idea how he got into this business. And he just wants, he has 21 grandchildren. And he just wants to make sure.
Big family.
Yeah, seven children. He just wanted to make sure his grandchildren have an idea what their pawpaw did. I think that's kind of nice.
Yeah, it is.
Well, thank you.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Yes. And our surprise turned out to not be a surprise.
Yes.